Blog Talk Radio.
I don't know nothing about that. All I know is that somebody is going to get their ass whooped over this thing.
Okay, hello. I am back. For good or for bad. I hope the sound is good. It says there's a problem with the chat, but it says if you try to reboot it, their engineers have been notified and will get it fixed. In many cases, it will work the second time if you try again. I'm not really sure how to try again, so maybe if I refresh it. Okay, hopefully this doesn't reload the whole page and mess it up, but I'll try. All right, hopefully I'm still here. Well, I'm still where I am. Okay. Said the same thing. All right, hopefully this is still broadcasting. It says the call is connected, so. Okay, I titled this one, I guess just the Chris Show, but I'm trying to leave them as open as possible so I can discuss as much, you know, as wide of a range of topics as possible. Let's see here. I think last week we ended off on the Bible verse that was from Genesis 49:8 that said, Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and as an old lion. Who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. There's a bunch of different versions of that. That was from the King James Bible, a copy that was given to me. Some of them sound more ominous than that one reads, but it was in keeping with the movie The Lion King that came out. Since they re-released it with a live-action cast, I felt that it was appropriate because that's really who the Lion King is and what they're talking about in that movie, what it's actually about, the balance, Simba, and don't be fooled just because they use James Earl's voice as Mustafa, whatever his name was. I saw the first one. I didn't go back and watch it or rewatch it. And I believe it was Jeremy Irons as the brother. And what they were doing was they were replaying the Fisher King story, playing that out, themes in that, with the brother who's wounded, who's the weaker and wants to rule the kingdom and believes that he's the smarter, more rightful, and he partners up with the darker races who are portrayed as hyenas, and they use the voices of the characters to portray who they really think. So it's like deceiving because you think the movie is set in Africa and that it's some cow paying some homage to, you know, to the history there, but really it's one of these white Christian roots, you know, identity Christian type things where they're supposed to remember who they were. They were cast off, Simba being the representative, being cast off, run off after being framed for his father's death. And in the beginning, everything is balanced. All the other animals representing the other groups bowing down at the beginning when he's born on Pride Rock, because sacrifices and things were always done under rocks, under trees. And it's not his father, it's the priest, the monkey that picks him up and holds him up to display him to everyone. And everything's balanced with the sun, and it's Leo. And everything is good, and there's a bountiful crop. And you got that same symbolism that you have in that new movie, because it's always like, whether it's The Wicker Man or The Running Man. The Running Man is The Wicker Man. That's a little secret with that. The bountiful crops and the sacrifice and all that stuff with the strong man of the tribe. If you think about it, the reason they would do that, take the strongest man from a tribe, plot against the guy. In fact, this was the plot of The Running Man. At the end, when he defeats in the book, which was written by Stephen King under a pen name, which a lot of his books may have been, because he was kind of shot out at the end. But this one went back, I think, he wrote it under the name of Richard Bachman, I believe. Well, the idea was, whether you go back, you know, into the fertility rites and all that sort of stuff, taking the strongest guy from the tribe, if you were the chief or the king or whoever of the tribe, and you were running the outfit with a priest, because the priesthood was the power behind the throne, because they understood the science of the day, the math and the science of the day, and the bloodline was the priest or the king or the ruler, in conjunction with the power behind the throne being the priesthood, because they would understand, like they did in Apocalypto, when the solar eclipse would happen. And that's why that movie Apocalypto is not exactly historically accurate, because it's trying to tell a story about how the rise and fall of civilizations and this same story keeps playing itself out over and over. That civilizations, you know, they centralize into some part of a city where they build pyramids in a pyramidal power structure, quite literal pyramids in the movie Apocalypto. And that power converges at the top with the bloodline king at the top, winking in the movie Apocalypto to the priest, who knew that there was going to be an eclipse, and that the people who were at the bottom of the pyramid, literally at the bottom of the pyramid, would not know, would get scared, and that they would sacrifice all the strong men in the tribes and the surrounding outlying lands. And as they got closer and brought into the city, and this is the same theme going through this, even in the book about the kids on the island, The Lord of the Flies. Even as they got brought in, they get captured. For people who haven't seen the film, you should see it. It's basically what Mel Gibson did was he learned from the guy that directed Mad Max that the one thing you couldn't do on a play and the one thing that you kind of couldn't do on TV, but you could do in a movie very perfectly, was you could put up this scenario of the chase scene. And it was one thing that worked very well in film form. It was almost unique to the film form. So if you watch the first half of that movie, it's him being captured when he's in this tribe. His wife is pregnant. He has another child. Jaguar Paw is the main guy you follow. And they live in this prosperous little village outside of the main area, which would be the city, and it has the pyramids and stuff. And they kind of live oblivious to that, because I don't think they've ever been that far, you know, over there. They sort of live away from it. And at the beginning, a sick tribe comes by. And the father, who's the chief, Jaguar Paw's his son, says they have the sick they have the sickness of, and it's not specific, but then they tell a story, and basically it's a theme that runs through there, and what's going to happen is that things are going to go bad after that, after this tribe. It's sort of like a foreshadowing. So the next day they get raided by these guys who are like bounty hunters for the powers that be within the center of the city where they're doing the sacrifices in the pyramids. And anybody that knows a little bit of the history knows they did a lot of bloody sacrificing there. So ostensibly it takes place in South America. I don't know if it ever states where it takes place, but they are speaking other languages. It's trying to be authentic, but there's people who have critiqued it for the some historical inaccuracies, but that's because it's the overall story and message that they're trying to get across through the prologue that says civilizations rise and fall, but they're usually taken down from within. So they get this tribe of Jaguarpa. He's managed just to hide his wife in this hole, because all the other women get attacked and raped, and it's pretty bad. They get marauded. And then they take the strongest men and they link them together and they march them into the center of the town. They don't know what's going on. They kind of hit them while they were sleeping. So there's this one sociopathic guy that's one of these bounty hunters, and he says, I'm going to call you Almost, because Jaguarpa almost gets the drop on him and sort of, knocks him out. And then he spins around to something and hits him at the last minute. So his friend, and him, they get the last of the strong men get marched into the closer and closer to the city. And as they get closer, they start to see the decay and the destruction of the industry. They get to see the plague. They get to see a little girl that tells them a prophecy of what's going to happen and how everything's going to fall apart. And she kind of scares them, but they keep going. And it's all on the eve of this celestial event that's going to happen. And they don't know why they're being marched towards there. And as they get closer and closer, they start to see what would be the city with the pyramids. And they get led up to the top, and one by one, stretched out on a rock and sacrificed with a sacrificial blade, and their hearts removed. Now, it's a little bit interesting, I'd say, that this culture was building pyramids and was trying to appease the gods through blood sacrifice. I believe it was Quetzalcoatl, which was the feathered snake. I might be wrong, but it's interesting that that imagery, and that they, wanted to do that, thought that would appease them. So at the very last minute, Jaguarpa is spared because the eclipse happens, and the priest or the king, they wink at each other, and one of them says, okay, the god is of the moon or whatever is satiated. He's had enough blood. But they still have these guys left over that they need to kind of get rid of, that they brought from this tribe that they marched all the way there. So they say, okay, we'll give you a running chance, take off, and we'll give you a chance to zig and zag, but we're going to throw stuff at you. So some of them, almost make it, because there's like a cornfield behind them, but it's like a dirt, almost like a volleyball court. They're running, in the sand, beach volleyball. So they're running, and a few of them almost make it. And then there's a guy who stands in the back, like an outfielder, and he cracks them on the skull just in case they make it past the javelins and whatever else they're throwing at them. It's been a little while since I've seen the whole thing. It's pretty gory. So Jaguarpa makes it all the way. And what happens is that through a little bit of trickery and smarts, he kills the kid in the back. That's the catcher. And it turns out that that's the head bounty hunter guy's son. So he's pissed. And they all go after Jaguarpa. He's basically the last surviving guy. And then the second half of the movie turns into a chase movie, because he learned from, and I can't believe I'm forgetting the name of the guy, that made Mad Max. It'll come to me in a second. He was a doctor. He actually left me and a doctor to make movies. That's going to bother me. Well, George something. So he learned from him that this idea of the chase scene, you know, that's unique to movies, it's tense. Some people hate it and some people like it because it's almost like that ticking time bomb scenario. Like in the movie Speed, is kind of utilizes that, where you have a bomb and the characters don't know. There's a movie with Jake Gyllenhaal that does that too, where he's on a train and he has to keep trying to reset the bomb and it keeps resetting him. He keeps blowing up. I forget the name of that movie, Source Code. So anyway, Jaguar Pa has to race back, and where the historical inaccuracy comes in is at the very end, and that would be a big spoiler. I don't know if I should ruin the movie for seeing, but basically there's a clash of civilizations, and people said, well, that didn't happen for like 300 years after, so that was inaccurate. So I'm not saying when or what happens, but that's one of the big gripes with it. But that's the point. Is that a civilization collapses from within and another civilization rolls in and just, you know, steamrolls over the rest of them. So that is Apocalypto. And that was Mel Gibson. And a lot of people say, not a lot of people, but some person on the internet, I think his channel is called Logos Made Flesh. And I'm all about the logos. This guy is a good... he's good at breaking down movies. He's good at the symbolism. And he said that's actually a sequel, if you watch it, to The Passion of the Christ. He said if you watch how it goes, it's actually a corollary in a way. So check that out. He does a good breakdown of how that's possible. And people who are fans of that movie, they're both bloody movies, people who are fans of that will maybe like that. And speaking of bloody movies and that story itself being bloody, I happened to stumble across, I hope I'm talking loud enough, by the way. I happened to stumble across because I do have a microphone I could plug in. I happened to stumble across a guy named, there's a group called Jews for Jesus, Messianic Jews, things like that. And for some reason in my searched videos, it showed a Jews for Judaism. And I gave it a listen to because it looked familiar. And what it was about was, at least the way I understood it, was that because of all the tradition in Judaism and because it's a small religion, there's a lot of... not apostate Jews, but there's a lot of secular Jews or world, you know, Jews that are not observant. What they want to do is, when they saw the rise of Jews for Jesus or Messianic Jews or whatever those were called, they thought that what would happen was that the original religion would be kind of wiped out and replaced. And they call Christianity replacement theology. So I understand why you would want to, if you were Jewish or born into Judaism, you were observant, why you would want to, you know, preserve your, you know, all those thousands of years of tradition and stuff. And having lived in a Orthodox community and watching how dedicated the really observant Jews were and how often how many holy days they had and just how much they had to walk and all the things they had to do to follow their religion. And, you know, I kind of, let me think of a movie that ran two times that I have a little connection with because it came out when I was growing up. And the boy in the movie, I think, I'm going to look this up, was around my age when it came out. And this has happened to me a few times in my life where the movie came out and there was a huge either coincidence or parallel at the time, where the person in the film, you know, was going through a similar, almost exact situation that I was. And I had relatives. The movie I'm talking about is called Witness. And in fact, I'm going to look up how old the boy was. I know him right. What was his name? Well, anyway, it was on the other day, and it was on again. And I said, you know what? There's a lot about this movie that I want to talk about because it's interesting. It had a whole opening. The people that wrote it, there, I think they might be kin. We might be related. And it was nominated for 8 Oscars. It's a really good film about, and it's very accurate too. When you go there, in fact, I'll get into it in a second. I just really want to find out how old this kid is because it will give you an idea. Lucas Haas, that was his name. Right, how old is Lucas? Oh my God, he's older than I am. Okay, so Lucas Haas has got to be in his 40s. And in this movie, he is a little tiny pipsqueak, and he looks like he's about 1984. You know, he looks like he's about 8 years old. So all I wanted to do was, I had seen the movie when I was a little kid. I was about his age when I saw it, so I guess I was about 7 or 8. And I got it. You know, I got the whole thing. It was actually... even though there was a little bit of violence, I think it was age appropriate. Now, don't go showing your kids the movie just because I said that. My family was taking me to R-rated movies when I was like 2 years old because I was very well behaved, and they thought that equaled maturity. And, you know, we didn't know a lot of the stuff that we know now. But I don't know if it was traumatic or not going to see kind of adult movies when I was a kid. And when I say adult, I mean like, you know what I mean. Like not kid movies, but I saw a little bit of everything. They didn't have ill intent. They just brought me to them. Okay. What I was trying to find out was, if you don't know the plot, I'll read the plot in a minute. I was just trying to find out how the father died because it's pretty traumatic what happens at the beginning. And I'm going to go into the 2 levels of symbolism in the movie. I'm going to go into the kind you would talk about in school, and I'm going to go into the kind that we talk about on OCS 101. I'll read the plot off Wikipedia. In 1984, an Amish community attends the funeral of Jacob Lapp. That's the father. I don't think we ever get to see or meet him, and I could not for the life of me find out how he died. I even Googled it. Who leaves behind his wife, Rachel, and their 8-year-old son, Samuel? Rachel and Samuel travel by train to visit Rachel's sister, which takes them into Philadelphia. Now, it says they go to 30th Street Station. When I was a kid, we had relatives. When I was his age, we had relatives living in Philadelphia or on the, you know, around Philadelphia. And they lived near this Amish community that was portrayed in this movie. And we went to the same train station, but I thought it was Grand Central Station, or there was some kind of Mandela effect with that, where they changed the name and it was never Grand Central Station. But I didn't want to go down that rabbit trail. While waiting for a connection train at 30th Street Station, Samuel goes into the men's room and witnesses the brutal murder of an undercover police officer, but manages to evade detection by hiding in the stalls. Now, the way the guy is murdered is with a knife by 2 guys in the men's room. Detective John Book is assigned to the case where he, along with his partner, Sergeant Elton Carter, questions Samuel. Although Samuel is unable to identify the perpetrator from mugshots or a lineup, he later sees a newspaper clipping in a trophy case of narcotics officer James McPhee, played by Danny Glover, receiving an award, and points him out to Book. Now, Harrison Ford's character's name is Book, and I said, you know, that symbolically, that would mean that he does things by the book, that he's and that sort of comes across, that he's a, in fact, there's a part in the dialogue where, well, let me finish I'll finish that, and I'll go into the backstory that they excised. Book investigates and finds out that McPhee, Danny Glover, was previously responsible for a seizure of expensive chemicals used to make black market amphetamines, but the evidence has now disappeared. So there were dirty cops, and basically they did this hit on this guy. Book surmises that McPhee himself and the kid witnessed it. That Book, John Book, Harrison Ford, thinks that McPhee himself fenced the chemicals to drug dealers and that he murdered the detective that had been investigating the theft, the guy in the bathroom. Book expresses his suspicions to Chief of Police Paul Schaefer, played by that German actor, who's actually still alive. Makes a good bad guy. He was in one of the X-Men movies. He played the president, who advises Book to keep the case secret so they can work out how to move forward. The world that Book lives in is the carnal world, the world that we all live in, and the Amish world is portrayed as this bucolic, idyllic, peaceful, you know, Christian sort of a bubble, you know, that's fenced off from the rest of the world. Since only Schaefer knew of Book's suspicions, Book realizes, I don't want to get into the themes until I read the synopsis. Since only Schaefer knew of Book's suspicions, Book realizes Schaefer is also corrupt and tipped off McPhee. Realizing that Samuel and Rachel are now in grave danger, Book orders his partner to remove all traces of the Lapps, that's their last name, from his files, and drives the boy and his mother back home to Lancaster County, where they could disappear within their community. While attempting to return to the city, Book's loss of blood causes him to pass out in the vehicle in front of their farm. So he has to stay there. Rachel argues that taking Book to a hospital would allow the corrupt police officers, because they buried the file, so nobody knows about the crime, and only the corrupt cops are coming to look for him, and he's been shot. So he's sort of stuck there, and he's at their mercy, just like they were at his mercy when they were in the city. Rachel argues that taking him to a hospital will allow those police officers to find him while putting Samuel in danger. Her father-in-law, Eli, who lives with her, reluctantly agrees to shelter him despite his distrust of this outsider. He calls them the English. Be careful out there among the English. And that line comes back later. Book slowly recovers in their care. He says it to Rachel before she departs. And then at the end of the movie, he says it to Harrison Ford. Book slowly recovers in their care and begins to develop feelings for Rachel, who likewise is drawn to him. The Lapp's neighbor, Daniel Hochleitner, played by the late actor who was in Die Hard, the blonde guy, had hoped to court her, and this becomes a cause of friction. During his convalescence, where he's getting better, Book dresses in Amish garb in order to avoid drawing attention to himself. She dresses him like her dead husband, who I don't know what he died of, but his pants are too short and he's dressed all in black and he doesn't wear the summer hats that they wear. They wear kind of like these straw hats during the summer. Basically, what happened was, let me finish the synopsis. Book dresses in Amish garb in order to avoid drawing attention to himself. His relationship with the Amish community deepens as they learn he is skilled at carpentry, just like he is in real life, interestingly enough. And there's an inside joke where they ask Harrison Ford, when they asked him if he could help to do the barn raising, and he says it's been a while, because it's a meta joke saying that, like, yeah, it's been a while since he actually did that for a living and seems like a decent, hardworking man. He said he learned by a book, by the way, that one day he just picked up a book and taught himself how to make things. And you can buy furniture and stuff in Hollywood that he made years and years ago. I guess he was actually really good at what he did. He, Harrison Ford, and not as good as he was at crashing airplanes, because he crashed in the middle of that Star Wars movie when they were filming that remake. He's invited to participate, in a barn raising for a newly married couple, which has been parodied and lampooned in the movie Kingpin, where he runs off when they ring the dinner bell. And they say, I don't know what part of Ohio or wherever he says he came from, but nobody runs off at the dinner bell when we're raising a barn. He goes, Brother Hezekiah, you know what the Bible says about not forgiven people? And he goes, no, why don't you tell us what it says? And Woody Harrelson's character says, it's against us. Okay, so it says, they do the barn raising for the new married couple, gaining Hawk Leitner's respect. That's the guy from Die Hard. However, the attraction between Book and Rachel is evident and clearly concerns Eli and others, causing much gossip in the tight-knit community. That night, Book inadvertently observes Rachel bathing. It's actually not like that. He kind of does, but she was kind of like presenting herself. But as she stands half-naked before him, he walks away, fearing of becoming too involved. Now, here's the differences in the original script. I'll do that before I get into the second half. If you haven't seen this movie, turn it off and go watch the movie before you listen to the rest, because it's a good movie. The characters are, you know, well written. It was nominated for 8 Oscars. It's got some of the dark things in Hollywood, but it's got more. I think it balances with some of the really good things. I'll tell you one thing about the backstory first. Okay, some of the parts that they omitted from it that make more sense was that the reason the guy was called Book, John Book, was that Harrison Ford's character, was that he was originally written to be an internal affairs guy, so he policed the police, and or something to that effect. I don't know if he was exactly IA or what, but he was supposed to be like policing the police force, so the other cops resented him, so he kind of already was on a power trip when you meet his character. And his partner, which was cut out of the script, was supposed to meet the guy, the undercover cop, in the bathroom before he got whacked. And he felt bad about that. So those things gave their characters a little bit of depth. And it gave the story more of a, you know, explained why his character was Book and why he did things by the book. You know, you don't really get a sense of that. And when you make a movie that's laden with themes like this one is, you kind of have to explain, because I watched it, you know, all these years going back to 1984. And, you know, I was like, well, I guess that's the reason, but without doing further research, like until Wikipedia and stuff came out, I didn't know. I figured that was what it was. Or I figured he went by his book as opposed to the Amish way of life, which is pretty accurate. They talked about the only people having a phone were their Mennonite neighbors, and that's true. A lot of people get the Mennonites not confused, but they're similar to the Amish, except that they have modern, you know, they live more with cars, and you know, they have the same sort of stuff as everybody else. The Amish do shunning, and they are more insular, and they don't have, you know, electricity. They don't, some of them cheat, like in the Amish mafia, because I think they kind of have to have some guys that are gonna, you know, that actually will fight and do that sort of thing. And also, this is just an aside that I thought was funny. In the Superman movie, the new one, I think it was called Man of Steel, when the showdown happens with Zod, the new Zod, played by Michael Shannon, he says, I grew up a military, you know, tactician or whatever the hell he grew up being. And he goes, where did you grow up? On a farm? And it's like, do you know how strong you'd have to be to grow up on a farm and how much work you have to do? Like, what are you talking about? Like, that's not an insult in any kind of a way. You got to get up early. In fact, that's one of the jokes in this movie, is that when he starts to heal, because Harrison Ford gets blasted by Danny Glover and the bullet enters and exits, and they refer to it as his hole. Well, anyway, it goes through. It penetrates him and goes through him. I'm not trying to be gross. I'm just saying what happens. And what happens is that I'm really not. And what happens is that he has a fever and all that sort of stuff. But when he gets better, the the father, the older Amish guy, says, you know, hey, now that you're better, get up early, like 4:30 in the morning, and milk the cows and help us out on this farm. See, that reason why they were going into town was they were going to see if they could find a new husband, because they needed one real fast and in a hurry to work the farm. You know, there was a lot of work to be done on there. I watched this show on these strongmen that went around the world, and there were guys that worked on farms that could match these 6'5", 350-pound guys. They could outwork them, you know, physically. There was, I mean, just crazy chores and things they had to do. It was unbelievable. The only thing that the big strongmen could do that they couldn't do was, like, fold frying pans. So, I mean, you know, don't diss the farm people. I don't know if maybe there are modern conveniences that have made things a little bit easier, but I don't think it's that easier. You know, a bale of hay is still a bale of hay, and, you know, you still got to feed the animals and stuff. So, I mean, you get my point. So, there's a scene in the movie that's sort of that theme, and the boy, the reason why I wanted to know why his father died is because he's obviously going through all this trauma of having his father die, and then he's never been to the city. So he goes to the city, he witnesses a murder, so that's pretty traumatic. And what happens is that after that happens to him, and Harrison Ford gets stuck on the farm, the grandfather and the mother complain about his gun. They complain about him showing him the gun and how they are against that. So the grandfather sits him down because Harrison Ford was trying to explain that when the gun doesn't have bullets in it, it's safe. And when it has bullets in it, it's not safe. So the mother, you know, Rachel, she freaks out. So she must, it's implied that she makes him sit down with his grandfather to explain to him, you know, why they're anti-gun. So they're sitting down at the table, and the grandfather says, I'm going to paraphrase it, something to the effect of, many times throughout history, he's got the little boy in his lap, and his name is Lap. So he's got the little boy at the table in his lap, and he says, this gun of the hand, a handgun, is for the taking of human life. And he says, we basically, you know, we reject that. He said, many times throughout history, we've been asked to fight to preserve the good, and people told us it's the only way. And we said, no, there's always another way. There's always more than one way. So the boy says, I've seen the bad men. You know, I would kill. He says, would you kill these men? Would you kill these bad men? And he says, how would you know that they're bad? He says, can you look into their heart and see this badness? And the son says, I can see what they do. So he says, and by seeing, you become. So then the boy says, the grandfather continues and says, I think he quotes a Bible verse, and he basically says, touch not the unclean thing, come out from among them, and be ye separate. So the general theme raised right there is the boy is sort of has a black and white idea of, you know, he's seen this death, you know, he had his dad die, he's seen these guys brutally murder this other guy, and he knows that there's, you know, real evil in the world, and that there's one way that you can deal with it, and you can see the way men act, and there's a way that you could stop it. So that gets to the heart of what the movie's called and what the other way is. What is the other way? What would be the other way? So as the movie goes on, I read all these different reviews for it, and they said, well, you know, that's just the MacGuffin, the murder part and all that sort of thing. It's really an exploration of, it's a love story with the backdrop of the Amish, almost like a documentary about the Amish. And then that's true. It's very close because the tourists, they really do take pictures, and the Amish people put their hats down, you know, And I felt really bad when I was a little boy seeing that, because I felt bad for them. I felt embarrassed for them. I felt embarrassed to be with the touristy kind of group that would, you know, ride around looking at their houses. And in the movie, she says, they sometimes come up into our yards, very rude. And I saw all that. And I, you know, it was at the same time that this movie came out, and I was like, it really resonated. So I was like, I want to run away and be Amish. But then, you know, it was, I think you have to be raised into the life. I don't know if you could do that. I think Fritz Springmeier might have done that. In fact, when I interviewed him, he said he did. So that little theme right there about, you know, what is the other way? What is the other way? So the movie goes on, and Harrison Ford is hiding because there's no phones, you know, there's no electricity, there's no way to find him. He's pretty well hidden, and he's healed up, and he's raised the barn, and he's fallen in love with the woman, but he knows that either she'll have to leave there or he'll have to stay there. Well, he goes into town to use the phone where the tourists meet up with the Amish, and they trade. And what happens is that a woman tries to take his picture, like the tourists really do in real life. And he says a funny line. He says, lady, if you take my picture with that thing, I'll rip your brassiere off and strangle you with it. And then smiles at her. And it's funny, but it gives him away. Then he goes over to use the telephone in full view of everyone. And people are like, you know, why is he using the phone? And when he gets on the phone, he calls his boss, who he knows is the dirty cop, and the head of the, you know, the other two dirty cops. And he says, I found out my partner was killed basically, you know, by you, and I'm going to come get you. And he says, you said about dirty cops, they lost the way. Something like that. Christianity used to be called the way. Or he said, they lost their way. Or the lay lost the meaning. So there's a little rabbit trail to go off on, but that's what he says. And then the guy says, I like your style, the boss. But he comes out, he gets mad, you know, because he's so mad his partner was killed, and he knows these guys did it, and he's stuck over here, and he can't do anything, so he hangs up the phone. He's kind of making a scene about himself. So he gets into the buggy, and that's another thing that they portray really well in there. If you've ever been to Amish country, they ride around in buggies, and they hold up the traffic. Not too badly, but, you know, like that's a scene that's portrayed in there. It's an anachronistic sort of a scene when you see it. It's surreal to have the cars on the road and then to have the buggy with the triangle on the back reflector. So they show that. Well, anyway, he gets into the buggy. He's crowded in there. He's depressed. He's angry, sexually frustrated because he likes the chick. And he found out his partner was dead. And all of a sudden, these guys are messing with the horses. And if you watch the movie a few times, you can get what they're saying of why they're sort of messing with the Amish. It implies that they're patriotic Americans, and they say that the Amish won't fight for their country. Just like it harkens back to the conversation that Grandpa was having with the boy. And he says, yeah, they won't fight with you, and they won't fight for their country either. Basically, like, they're cowardly. But that's not necessarily true. Sometimes it takes more bravery to turn the other cheek. So they start to taunt the horses, and they taunt the guy from Die Hard with the ice cream on his face and his nose. So at this point, Harrison Ford has had it. John Book is his name. He's had it. And the grandfather says, don't, you know, just leave it be. And the other guys are saying, even the Lord of the Rings, the guy from Lord of the Rings is in there. And he tells them, hey, chill out. Well, Harrison Ford walks up to the guy that's taunting these Amish guys. And he says, ooh, because he thinks he's just another one of them. And he's going to, you know, he's not going to do anything. So he says, you're making a mistake, Harrison Ford says to this guy. And the guy says, ooh. And he blasts him, just activates his dental plan, knocks him out, breaks his nose, hits this other guy, you know, busts them all up. Everybody sees, makes a big scene because he's just wrecking dudes. And then they sort of, you know, get him back into the buggy and on their way. And that's what gives away his location of where he's at. So he goes back, has a little kiss with the mom in the original script, they actually consummate the relationship, which would have been all kinds of problems, you know, just in case he got her pregnant, if they had put that part in. So in the movie, they just have a kiss. And it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of nice. So then up on the hill, you see the three police closing it. And I'm going to get to the point of what the other way was besides violence. So these three other police officers, these crooked cops that lost their way or lost the meaning, whichever it was, they come to send on this idyllic, peaceful farm. And they got a shotgun, and the other guy, I think, has a shotgun, and the other guy, I think, has the chief has a handgun. So the mother, because she didn't like Harrison Ford having his gun, was hiding the bullets in the sugar or something, or the baking, you know, somewhere, and the gun was somewhere else. So he gets caught by surprise, and he has to hide in this silo of corn. And he climbs up as high as he can, but the guy with the shotgun, one of the dirty cops, is down below. And he's aiming his shotgun up there, and Harrison Ford thinks, uh-oh, this is it, I'm done, but he can't see him. So he pulls the grain, and the guy gets cornholed. He literally gets corned to death, and he can't get out. So Danny Glover runs up, Harrison Ford dives into the corn, and he digs out the shotgun. I think he blasts him, and you know, it's kind of like Danny Glover shot him earlier, so it's kind of like payback. So the last guy is the captain. Now, nobody knows about this case. If these guys had killed Harrison Ford and killed the witness, the little boy, in fact, there's a line earlier in it, after he sets up a place for them to stay with his sister when they are in the city in Philadelphia. Now, it's in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. What happens is that she says, he says, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to stay here. And she says, you're not sorry, because now you have a witness. You know, there's a theme about this witness thing. And him, you know, making her stay with his sister, and her sister telling her how he doesn't have a family of his own. You know, and it could be a perfect situation for them both, but they don't ever come together. So anyway, the two cops, bad cops, are dead. No one knows about this whole thing that's going down. The only two guys that are left are the chief, Harrison Ford, John Book, and then, of course, the little boy. So what does the guy do? He takes the family hostage, and because I guess he's not used to doing his own dirty work. His corrupt cops are doing the dirty work for him. And the little boy rings the bell for the other Amish guys to come. You know, the grandfather sees him in the hall, and he goes, you know, motions for him to ring that bell. So they ring the bell. He rings the bell, and they all throw down, you know, what they're doing for miles around, and they come converge on the farm. So Harrison Ford, you know, has just taken out these other two guys, and the last guy is the boss, and he's got them, you know, hostage, and he's got the Samuel, the little boy, as the witness hostage. So Harrison Ford runs up on him, and they can't really have a showdown. I mean, what's he going to do, shoot him, you know? So he looks at him, and he says, what are you going to do? All these people are around. Are you going to shoot me? Are you going to shoot him? And the mother screams, because he means little boy. And the guy is, you know, shaking, and he's scared, the police chief. And he goes, what are you going to do with all these people around? And the guy realizes that he has been beaten. Not because he was outgunned, not because these guys were going to jump him or anything, even though in real life these Amish guys probably would jump him, but because the other way was by simply having a group of people around to witness. They didn't need to do anything violent. They didn't have to match violence with violence. By just sheer volume of numbers, them all standing there and observing and watching the corruption. He couldn't hide and do it. They had a bunch of witnesses this time. And by just witnessing, that was the peaceful solution. So the guy, you know, he throws his gun down or he surrenders, you know, peacefully without a shot having been fired, even though there's some violence, you know, prior to that. But that's the ultimate outcome for the, you know, the chief, is that, you know, he didn't have to punch him. He didn't have to fight him. He didn't have to wrestle him. He didn't have to do any of that. They just needed all of them to come and, you know, all be there as witnesses. And that was the other way. So I didn't know that when I was a little boy and I saw the movie. I didn't get that, obviously. The movie resonated on a bunch of levels because, you know, like I said, I went there, I saw it. I liked I also went to, it reminded me also, I went to some Quaker and Shaker communities, and it was a little bit similar. We had to, I forget why, we were doing an art show. My mom was doing an art show, and we had to go and stay up in, this might have been in Pennsylvania also, and it was very similar. You had to scrape the shit off your shoes before you walked in the door, and they made this really good lemonade and stuff, and it was great. So I like the whole theme. I like the whole movie. I like going to see it, and then I just happened to see it the other day, so I figured, hey, why not talk about it and share that little idea of what I thought the theme of the movie was. Excuse me for a second, because the light just went out and I can't see the screen. Hold on. We've had some horrible storms, and that keeps happening. So I don't know what to say, because, you know, it's there's a house up north, but they say that they're having just as much bad weather. But this is like off the chain, like thunder or lightning. It's crazy. I don't even know if I have a any kind of protection for this. Computer. But yeah, I hope you like the breakdown of that movie, and I think it's worth seeing, and I think there's some cool backstory they should have included. I think it's a good performance. I think there's some cool inside jokes, a lot of famous people in it that later became super famous, like the guy from Lord of the Rings being in there, and even the little boy went on to make Lucas Haas went on to make a lot of movies after that. And yeah, we learned that he's actually older than I am. I'm old. I'm older than Methuselah. But Anthony Hopkins played him in that horrible Noah movie, which was about the Noahide laws, which ties into that thing I was talking about earlier. I'm trying to find in my notes every time I want to give you guys this bibliography. But I'm also trying to find these I'm trying to find good, there was a good back and forth. Yes. I think it's past your bedtime. Okay, dead air. I don't want that. Well, anyway, I guess what I'll talk about, because it's getting close. A friend of mine who is, well, he's actually not really a friend of mine. Somebody whose work I followed. And he is kind of a vigilante. And even he, everybody's live streaming now. And they're doing the whole Owen Benjamin thing. They're live streaming and they're involving their family and they are, you know, they're making bank off of it. He has people mail him money and stuff, which is fine. But that template was around back in 2009, but I don't think they had the whole format that they have now. I don't even know. I think they maybe had Google Hangouts, but people have really been using it. And it looks like that whole thing that Andy Warhol said, 15 in the future, everybody will have their 15 minutes. And then someone reversed it and said, no, in the future, everyone will have 15 minutes of privacy. I think that's more likely. So I figure everyone will have some sort of a live stream vlog, and you'll include your family. Since we're all being watched anyway, we might as well all do a live format, and why not get paid for it? So when I saw, the reason why I brought up this guy, when I saw that even he was doing a live stream, I said, wow, that means everybody, if he'll do it, everybody will, because his whole profession, which he does not get paid for, being a vigilante, it requires secrecy, stealth, and all that sort of thing. So he's always sort of stayed in the shadows. So if he's doing a live stream, if he's going on the bandwagon, even though he said he was just doing a little test, I think, if he's doing it, then I think it's something that's, you know, really catching on. And now that there's so many different platforms besides YouTube, there's those other ones. I forget what they're called. BitChute, DLive. I forget what the kids are using these days. But, you know, they're all ways where you can sort of broadcast yourself. And, hey, once your picture's out there and you're comfortable behind the camera and you like to talk, people find you and, you know, they kind of become like family. They tune in and they like to just hear about your daily struggles and things. I'm trying to make the show ultimately, in fact, this is how I'll round this one out. My goal for this would be, obviously I started off with Bill from OCS 101, and what I wanted to do was, I like doing those shows with him, and maybe we'll keep doing some of those, but what I always wanted to do was a topical type of a show. I had guests before, which is why I'm not, and this was years ago, which is why I'm just getting reacquainted with. There, we got 90 seconds. If I can, I'll talk longer, but it's going to be like a little 3-minute break after 90 seconds. So if you guys want to wait around after that, I might talk just a little bit longer. I know you guys have suffered long enough, but in fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start that break, because that 90 seconds It's gonna cut off the live part. It'll keep recording. Okay, yeah, it says it's almost closing. Okay, good night. I'll stay on talking, and then for people that listen to it later, they'll hear that the entirety, in its entirety. All right, so good night for the live part. Okay, if it's still going, I'll talk just a little longer. Yep, that's what happens when you do a show live. You get interruptions, whether it be the weather or, you know, family or, you know, neighbors and whatnot. But there's a lot of stuff, I guess, that I want to get into that if I could structure the show, I would set it up for longer. If I could get a freaking babysitter, I'm not joking, it always falls through. That and this stupid freaking bill for this chancery court that I've been trying to pay six times. In fact, the lightning's going right now. That I've been trying to pay six times this lady sent me back. It's very similar to the situation in that movie, My Cousin Vinny, where there's this small town pride / I don't know, envy, where they want to show that they have a sophisticated system set up, even though they have not integrated their computer system. And every single time I send them a payment for the back taxes, they transfer me over, tell me a different amount, tell me I have to make it out to somebody else, that the amount went up, and so on and so forth, to the point where it's become absurdly ridiculous. And there's only one, just like in My Cousin Vinny, one person working in that entire office, probably that entire floor. And if they got the flu, like in the movie, the city would shut down, the county would shut down. I don't want to say the name. The county would shut down for, you know, the whole time the person had the flu, like in the movie. But like the judge says in My Cousin Vinny, we have every bit as sophisticated a system of law than you do. Well, hey, my family's from the town. I'm probably related to the lady that works in the office. It's that small of a town. I'm related to the sheriff. So I never met them, but, you know, they're distant cousins. So I don't have any kind of grandiose notions or anything about the people. I'm just trying to, it's this simple. I just want to know a price, an amount, who to make it out to, and when it needs to be there. And you'd think something like that should be, you know, pretty simple. But I have not used snail mail to pay bills in so long that, well, hey, I'm not putting this on me. This is on them. I sent a letter. I sent the money order. Then I said that wasn't the right amount. It was too high. And I can't imagine anyone have a problem with too much. Donate the extra cheese to your favorite charity. Keep it. I don't care. Obviously, if that's what I thought the amount was for, why are you making an issue? If they had kept the original money order with all the penalties, it's added up to that amount. So the lady sent it back to me. Then she wanted a check. I sent her a check and she said she couldn't take my check because it was out of state. But the city could. So I said, wait a minute. You're in charge of your office and what you can take. So is there any way you could work with me? Well, obviously not. And obviously the only person that had the problem was her. So what does that mean? That she was messing with me? So she sent that back. So I sent another money order. But the amount went up $3. And she said it was made out to the wrong place. I said, how could it be made out to the wrong place? You told me this amount. You told me to make it out to you. She said, I crossed it out and I put the right amount in. I said, you felt comfortable crossing out a money order and writing a different name in, but you didn't feel comfortable taking a check or a money order that was over by $20? It still hasn't been paid. And anyone that knows real estate knows that if you don't pay your, you know, property tax, that it goes to auction. So this was a house that got rolled over somehow into my name when my old man passed away. And all I'm trying to do is pay the back taxes on it and sort that out. You know, I'm trying to be in honor. I'm trying to do it honorably and not, you know, get angry and be polite. You could do a whole show on notes and all that, and I could post a bibliography. That's why I held back on that. It actually worked this time. So next week, if I try to do the bibliography, different books, maybe I'll list some of them right now if I can pull it up, because it is a good list. And okay, you know what? I'm going to name some of these books, because if you can get your hands on them, and a lot of them are on Google eBooks, these books are what they should be teaching in school, so that you can actually learn how to pay. It's actually not doing me any good, but for the most part. One of them is A Practical Treatise on Bills of Exchange, Checks on Bankers, Promissory Notes, Bankers Cash Notes, and Bank Notes by Joseph Chitty, C-H-I-T-T-Y, 1821. A Treatise on Presumptions of Law and Fact by William Best, 1845. A Treatise on Principles of Evidence, William Best, 1854. A Manual of the Law of Real Property, Charles T. Boone. His work is all really good on corporations. Manual of Law Applicable to Corporations, that's him also. 1883, A Treatise on American Citizenship by John Sargent Wise. Everybody has to read that. Supreme Court, 1906, Treatise on the Writ of Habeas Corpus by William Church. 1893, American Bar Association Journal, Volume 6, 1920. American Encroachments on British Rights, Nathaniel Atchison, 1808. American State Papers, Volume 1, 1832, Universal Pronouncing. I don't want to read. There's a lot more. It scrolls for a while. And if I start to read all of them and this doesn't get recorded somehow, I'll feel really dumb. And I want you guys to be able to avail yourselves of this information. You know, people say, the United States is the Admiralty and all that sort of stuff. Yes, that's all correct, but it's very nuanced. And basically, everything, everywhere, going all the way back to the very first mud hut, was a corporation. The United States was the first sovereign corporation. That was the only thing that, when they talk about that, and they try to really confuse and complicate this stuff. But basically, the way the joke goes is, and this is true, the very first time that somebody set up a mud hut along a stream, and the first prostitute was in there, the first guy that said, "Hey, I'm going to run this town, I'm the sheriff," was the first corporation, was the first town, was all of that rolled into one. And the next guy was the judge, and the next guy was whoever else. And it always went like that. That was basically from the beginning. So people say, "Oh, well, United States incorporated in 1871 or whatever it was." It was always a corporation. Always. And it went Reconstruction after the Civil War. Reconstruction reconstructed. They were basically assimilating the South into, I don't even know if I should get into it because I don't know if this is recording, but what do you guys think Reconstruction reconstructed? Now, I've listened to William Cooper on this stuff. I don't think Jones has ever done anything on it because I don't think he knows it. I think he just says color of law, and he brings on different people but basically avoid anyone who's trying to get you to argue inside of a courtroom, or anyone who's trying to get you to argue that you don't have to, boy, I'm trying not to be too specific so that it's not illegal. I'm trying to give you just the broad strokes. But basically, if you did it if you got pulled over for speeding and you were speeding, then, you know, you did it. So don't try to pull this crap that, like, you know, the jurisdiction, all that stuff, it doesn't apply, or whatever that guy, what is his name? He was on the Vinny Eastwood show, and I called in right after, and he didn't take calls, but he took my call. What is his name? The dark-haired guy. I think he's Italian. Man, I'm going to feel dumb when I can't remember his name. He read, like, one book by Lysander Spooner, who, yes, you should read. And the one that I say is Jury Trials in America. But he read, like, one of his books, and then he decided to become this, one of these, I don't know if he's a Freeman or like, no, the No State Project. That's what it is. He does the No State Project, and his thesis is, how can you be held responsible if you're passing through from, if you live in another state? So, like, my wife was coming home from a funeral on her birthday, and she got two tickets coming home in different states. And he would have said, if you don't live in this state, how can they hold you responsible to their, like, something to that effect? Because I think his idea is that, you know, the ground is not the state, and the city's not the state. It's basically a fiction. And how do they hold you to that? I think it's been a while since I've heard of his work, and I can't remember his name. Adventures in Legal Land. Mark. In fact, let me look it up. I told you I'm going to feel stupid not remembering it. Adventures in Legal. Can you hear the speed of that typing? Mark Stevens. I think I said his name. Mark Stevens. I don't dislike him personally. I think he wants you to argue in a courtroom, and you can get in big trouble doing that. Okay, yeah. So basically, if I understand it right, if he's still around, what he does is he gives you a script where you basically get the officer on the stand that gave you the ticket to try to give evidence as a witness or something. I forget. He used a pretty clever tactic, but it could go terribly wrong if you didn't have the, I think he gives you a card to use and everything. It's, you know, this stuff is fun in theory to look at, and it's good as an exercise in logic to study, and it's good to understand, because contextualizing it, the law and how it works, the statutes and things, you know, in a case by case example, that's the way you would do it. You know, just reading Black's Law, or, you know, whatever you might read, the Corpus Juris or whatever, is just, you know, that'd be abstract. So it's fun to take an actual case where someone was speeding or whatever they were doing. I think he even tried it criminally in some criminal cases, and it worked, he claimed. But the big guy that they got, and when I found out how rich this guy was, this really, really got my dander up. There was a guy, and I'm going to forget his name too. I must not have taken my brain force today. I'll remember his name as we go. He was one of these free man on the land guys, but he wasn't. He was doing classes, and he was having people come in, and he was basically saying, I just came out of prison, and I have a mantra that I get people to read. And it basically says, you have four doors that you can answer a question legally with. Yes, no, maybe, comply, or you can say, oh man, if I don't say it right, we'll have problems. and I'm not even remembering his name. Well, the point of it is, I'll go back to that next week, and I'll get myself into more trouble. But basically what happened with this guy was he got slammed when they got him back in court because they wouldn't let him represent himself. They basically gagged him. He wasn't allowed to do his spiel, and he had gotten out of prison. He was teaching classes. He was telling people not to argue with the police, and he was saying, don't do the whole sovereign thing. What was it, Gordon? No. I think it was Gordon something. And they had him on his case on video, and he doesn't get to talk, and that was it. They sunk him. And now I think he's doing the rest of his life. He's spending the rest of his life in there. All right. I don't know how long, much longer this is going to go, but I have another technical difficulty. If you guys want to hold, I'll come back and finish it up if I can. If not, I'll just end it, and we'll clip it. Yes, his name was Gordon. I just thought of it. I know what his whole name is, but I'm not going to say it. But he got blasted, man. Now he's doing the rest of his life in prison. But here's the kicker, and this is not touch on the legal stuff. He used to do this upon bona fide proof of claim. That was his thing. He had a mantra that people would memorize. You know, if they said, what's your name? And you'd say, I'll accept upon bona fide proof of claim that that's mine. I'll conditionally accept upon bona fide proof of claim that that is my name. So in other words, he wasn't saying yes, he wasn't saying no. He was saying, if you can present me with a document that says that that's me, then yes, I'll conditionally accept it, and I'll say that that's me. But of course, there was no way for them to ever prove that. It was like a catch-22. So he, it turned out, was one of like the, not the richest people in the country, but he had like the biggest house. He was this really rich guy. And he had done something, I think, with cars, or he started this, I got to look it up. And I said to myself, what would make this guy go to, he was on Lifestyles Rich and Famous. And he, you can't find that episode. You can't find the house. He had a house that like had his name on it. It had more rooms than any other house. Here, prison. And I thought to myself, what would make this guy? He was an exercise guy. That's what it was. Because I remember he wasn't really in good shape. And I was like, what is this, the deal with this guy? Former Arizona millionaire, Gordon. Known for flashy hyperbole, received an additional 96 months in prison for a tax scam. Trades millions mansion for prison cell. This was in 2015. The would-be god becomes a convict. I'd only been on the job a few months in 86 when I visited Gordon Blank in the story. Gordon trades millions mansion for prison cell. This was not just any ordinary mansion. This was like he said he wanted this thing to be, you know, the biggest, most ostentatious house in the world, and that apparently he got popped, I think, the first time, and then he said, you know, he learned the law while he was in prison, like so many of these guys, he saw the light, and when he came out, he knew what was really important, he started teaching this stuff, blah, 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 and then I guess they were doing work on tax stuff. Creditors and commerce, and he would talk about the private and the public, and, you know, not to go to war with the United States and all that sort of stuff, and, you know, not to be hostile when you get pulled over, like some of the people kind of were, you know, just kind of trying to waste the time of the police. And so his message was kind of like, you know, don't mess with them just to mess with them, but learn the law. And I think that was the takeaway. But I was like, why? Why is this guy doing that? And I think what happened was that when he got out of prison the first time, you know, that was the only thing he had to trade off of was this knowledge and this stuff. But when they finally got him and he had to go up, as far as I saw the video I watched, they didn't let him talk. So he wasn't able to, and he had a guy that he told that was going up and for murder. All these used to be on the internet. They might have taken him down. And he told him, just say what I tell you to say. And the guy supposedly said it. And, you know, he got some appeal or something. But this is going back a while. I think this is back in 2011. But what happened was that this second time that he got in trouble, it was weird enough the first time. The second time, you know, they put him away. I think this was for 96 months. So, you know, at his age now, it says Gordon Blank spent the 1980s playing the part of a larger-than-life Arizona millionaire. The person he most regularly tried to outdo was himself. The real estate developer and Nautilus Health Club entrepreneur lived on the edge of hyperbole, forever promising the biggest and best. He was going to plant a 62-story office tower on the Phoenix skyline, the biggest, he bragged about, someday becoming a trillionaire, the wealthiest. He lived in a 52,000-square-foot mansion, the best. But Hall, now 61, will likely spend most, if not all, of his golden years in substantially smaller and far less comfortable accommodations, a federal prison cell. He was sentenced last week to 96 months in prison for orchestrating a $93 million tax scam with roots in the sovereign citizen movement. That's on top of 180 months he's already serving for his involvement in a South Carolina Ponzi scheme. Why would a guy who's a real estate developer and is tied in with Nautilus Health Club as an entrepreneur jeopardize that? And if you really hear the whole story of, you know, how big his house was and the whole lifestyle, the rich and famous and all that sort of stuff, it really doesn't make any sense. Participants in a scheme like this typically range from clueless victims who get bad advice to willing participants who could be charged criminally. The spokesman for the IRS Criminal Investigation Division in Phoenix said, Watson said anyone who paid him hoping to get out of a tax debt still owes the IRS. These bogus filings don't relieve someone's tax debt, and the taxpayer could be penalized for sending the documents to the IRS. What you really have to ask yourselves is, why are these people out there in the first place? What was the whole Black Panther movement about? What was the whole COINTELPRO movements about? Why are they getting people to learn the law and then go out and be hostile and fight and go out and argue it and get themselves into big trouble? You know, why don't they just teach the law? Why is it, why are all the politicians bar associates? And that's what that ABA journal that I listed was about how they all were, they all decided that since lawyers were a scorned and hated bunch, that they should all write the laws because they understood it and they had a lot in common. Wow, he had a skating rink, a swimming pool, a tennis court, a 14-car garage, and you know what? I don't want to go into this whole thing. I'm going to save it for next week. So I'm going to kill it right there, and I'll see you guys. If that records, because if it's not recording, and I just talked for all that time, that's just stupid. So, so I'm going to end it right there. Good night, God bless, and check out OCS 101 ARC. You'll find it if you type that in. And check out Bill's Vids, and hopefully he'll come on, and we'll do a show at some point, a fun one. Okay. I'll have a topic for next week to start with. Okay, bye.